Blog Talk Radio.
Because we want to stay alive in Torah time, instructions of life, Torah Ches, instructions of mercies, all different types of instructions emanating from the Torah. We're listening now to the entry song into our show of Soul Class number 169, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah number 39, and this is Yitzhak Paton's Here Comes the Time from his Generation Redemption album. Oh, we just quickly shut it off, not the most professional manner. Hopefully we're going to queue up another song later from my computer. And joining us now today and reuniting with your humble cyberspace Torah activist, Lanzus Yugudman, is Dennis Ryan, our teacher, our student, our advocate and advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, and our Noah Hyde Chassid, Ron Williams. Good morning, Dennis, and good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Don and Ron.
Good morning, Dennis and Don.
And I would suggest anyone, if you want to practice your verbal expression in terms of your ability to vocalize in a cute way, say Dennis, Don, and Ron, Ron, Dennis, and Don, and Dennis, Don, Ron 50 times, and then keep on repeating that cycle and see how quickly your tongue becomes more versatile.
Or paralytic,
yeah. Dennis, just don't get too analytic with my silliness right now. Let's give a little brief description of what we're going to go into, Ron and Dennis. Dennis and Ron, blessed is our creator. Well, and further, another well. It is swell to reunite with you, blessed souls. We are 39th installment of In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah, featuring our co-hosts, who I just introduced, Dennis Ryan and Ron Williams. We hope to move into vibing within the wisdoms of Rambam, Chabad Hasidus, Rabbi Nachman, The Path of the Righteous Gentile, Compassion for the Humanity in the Jewish Tradition, plus whatever comes down the pipeline of live internet radio discussions. Last but not least, we hope to read from Genesis chapter 2, verse 12, quote, "And the gold of the land is good, there is bdellium and the onyx stone," end of quote. And before we get into that, gentlemen, you know, truth comes in very interesting ways. As I was preparing for the show, I was preparing to cue up a song, which I hope to play at the halfway break of our show, Hashem's Blessings, a song called "Children of the Earth" by Yahaziel Fox in Florida. Now, I don't know this person, but he wrote a song which to me echoes a very ancient feeling within the human super or subconscious experience of the reaction of Adam, original man, after the original sin. So I posted it on my Facebook page, which is Don Zussi Goodman. Anyone can check it out and want to link up with me, and then you can therefore also connect with the Blog Talk Radio efforts. So someone wrote to me in a question. They said, so you're a Messianic Christian. And I was thinking, wow, I wonder how she read into that one. So let's start off with the show. Dennis, do I give you the impression that I'm a Messianic Christian?
You give the impression that you're not following the classical lines, Don. You're open-minded. And people don't like that because they have a hard time putting you into a category. Because a lot has been said in history, and a lot of people hope that the lines of history will hold. But you've got to remember, throughout the history of mankind, we have people who are called thinkers. That doesn't mean they are bad. You can follow God and think at the same time.
Thank you, Dennis. Ron, what's your take? You know me 5 years. Did I ever impress you as a Messianic Christian?
Actually, I think they just got it a little mixed up. The fact that the originator of the Christian religion is Jewish, and you're Jewish, and the whole idea of a Messianic era is actually coming, so they kind of like just mix up the the criteria a little bit. So anyone who's a devout Christian who's also waiting a Messiah, and you know, they understand that, you know, the Jewish people also are waiting a Messiah, so they kind of feel that there's a kind of, they kind of intertwine. So
right. I just want to comment that, first of all, I want to publicly declare I'm not a Messianic Christian, and the truth is I don't have a problem with Messianic Christianity, or if there's such a thing called Messianic Islamic belief, because the Rambam himself writes in his laws, not in his philosophy, but his lawful teachings in the Mishnah Torah, that the belief system of the Christians and the belief system of the Muslims is part of preparing the way for the redemption for the entire human being experience. So I, in a sense, am a Jew that believes with simple faith in the coming of the Mashiach, the Messiah. And if he tarries today, I still will wait for him. And in the meantime, I'd like to mention something that this is something I saw yesterday in shul, in Shabbat, at the Frankel Shul, which is in Crown Heights, that there was a discussion that took place 23 years ago between the Lubavitch Rebbe and the two chief rabbis of Israel. And we have an oral Torah tradition that the Mashiach, Messiah, will first appear in Tiberias, which is Tiberia in Hebrew, which you break down the Hebrew words, it means there's a good sight. So the Rebbe mentioned that although, according to one path of oral Torah traditions, that before the Mashiach, Messiah, is fully arrived, we will get an announcement by none other than Elijah the prophet, which means Elijah will resurrect, Eliyahu Navi. And the Rebbe mentioned that no one's going to mind if Elijah even comes to Brooklyn to make the announcement if Mashiach will come tomorrow. So the main thing is we want Elijah the prophet to come. We want the prophets of all. We want Adam to come back. We want Noah to come back and Abraham to come back to guide us in the ancient ways, which is basically the theme of that song, which I'll be playing in about 25 minutes by Hazieller, H. Fox from Florida. And afterwards, gentlemen, or anyone who wants to call in at 1-347-838-8669, you're more than welcome. Actually, I will be going in about 34 minutes, I should say. We hope to play the song. To give your opinion on this song, if it's pushing a Christian viewpoint, and I think it's pushing a universal human viewpoint, which goes back to Adam, and Adam wasn't Christian, Adam wasn't Jewish, Adam wasn't a Muslim. He was a human being created by the very handiworks of the Most High. With that being said, blessed souls, I want to cut into a segment that we started last time, which wow, we haven't had a show since March 25th, based on a teaching, a graduate school paper for the promotion of an idea of a new American academy, a new model of education. And this was done by, at the time, six graduate students at Harvard University, Almi Abeta, Robert Garcia, Guadalupe Guerrero, Beth Schiavano Narvez, Latoya Walker, and my good friend and prayer mate, Shimon Warnke, who also prays at the Frankel Shul in Crown Heights, and also happens to be the I was about to say Rosh Hashiva, the principal, actually, not a Rosh Hashiva, he's a principal of PS 770, which is a school here in Crown Heights to try to elevate the children over here in Crown Heights, a secular school. And I'm just going to read, I think it's a very important point, because part of the spirit of the Noahide Commandments is to make the world a settled place, not through the process of brainwashing, but by giving everyone the opportunity to exercise and actualize their free choice. So again, I'm going to start off with this quote by John Stuart Mill. I think it's part of this general presentation, which we hope we do from week to week in a continual fashion. A general state education is a mere contrivance for molding people to be exactly like one another, and is the mold in which casts them is that which pleases the predominant power in the government, whether this be a monarch, a priesthood, or aristocracy, or the majority of the existing generation. In proportion as it is efficient and successful, it establishes a despotism over the mind, leading by natural tendency to one over the body. And that was philosopher and economist John Stuart Mill, 1863. And the point I want to reflect on with you gentlemen and you blessed souls listening out there is that I was talking briefly with Shimon yesterday, Shimon Warnke, one of the co-authors of this paper, and we talked about the cost of educating a child, and we're talking about a child from kindergarten to 12th grade, which is, what, 13 years of public school education. And it costs about $17,000 per child, which would include also the cost of special educational needs for those children who need special education, distinguished children. Now, that's 13 years. And on the other hand, I just looked on U.S. Department, let me just go to here. This is actually, according to the U.S. Justice Department, an average the cost of keeping a prisoner in jail on the average is between $22,000 and $25,000 a year. Now, some of these prisoners are serving longer than 12, 13 years in prison. Some of them serve life sentences. Some serve 20, 30, 40, 50 years sentences. And I'm not really interested in going into discussion, well, what do we do for those who commit capital punishment, but the overall cost to society, which was emphasized in a point made by the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I think it was 30 years ago, that America has to come to make a choice. Does it want to invest into the youth who are the future of this country and the future of the world, or to invest in jails? So therefore, now we're going to go right to the paper. Just going to take a little snippet every week and then hopefully feed off the perceptions and wisdoms of Dennis and Ron and Dennis. So in part 2 and 3 of this paper, we discuss the instructional core and content before the structure of the school design, which will be discussed in part 4. The reasoning is that often in education, structures are placed before the practice, and we want to ensure that the structures are serving the practice of teaching and learning, which I want to boil that down to, blessed souls, is that basically the structure is the idea, the philosophy, and it hasn't been put through the litmus test of practical experience. So therefore, whatever experience and knowledge, expertise has been generated by the think tech at each particular school or the general umbrella school system, hopefully it's with the foresight that when integrating a new perspective on how to educate children, it has to be based on some sort of practical outcomes in the past. And in the mental health field, we call it evidence-based systems or applications. So, Dennis, I'd like to go to now this idea of, you know, in order to ensure that we're investing more into children than more into the jails, which I think is really for the betterment ultimately of the basic sense of decency and security of the people in this country, what can we do to try to encourage other people to think about and talk about more about, as much as we certainly we want the economy to be strong in America, but we want to see the education in this country become more opportunistic for a wider branch of all the segments of our population.
50 years ago, or more than 50 years ago, this country treated education as a very respectful endeavor. Teachers were considered on the same level as the question that was proposed to kindergarten students. Do you want to be a president, a policeman, a fireman, a lawyer, or a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we treated teachers, because they always showed respect. Our parents always said, did your teacher tell you to do this, or did your teacher admonish you about that? Because they would follow up on that. Unfortunately, in the last 50 years, we have downgraded the teaching and education as a high priority. That's why we're spending more money on prisons. We're spending more money on other things as well, but let's not go there. What we did was basically push the educational concept, or the goal, which is to educate our future leaders, our future leaders of society, any way you want to look at it, is that we have downgraded that. By downgrading it, it allows other things to look like it's more important. So, yes, we need to focus, and we need to figure out from a society viewpoint what are the important things. It isn't just spending money there. We must make a commitment that we're going to educate the minds of young people.
Amen. Ron, again, you didn't get your primary education here in America, but rather in Guyana. How were teachers perceived in Guyana, in the culture that you grew up in? And again, the second question is, how can we encourage people to invest more in our future? The greatest resources of this country in America, and therefore in every country in the world, I would suggest and advocate, are the children of the generation.
Honestly speaking, I can only speak from my time when I attended high school, and one of the things where teachers were given a tremendous amount of authority, and even parents respected the teacher. A child went home and complained about a teacher behaving not appropriate or whatever it is. The parent would attend the school, and they would have a meeting with the principal, the teacher, whatever it is, and many times they wouldn't even discuss the outcome with the child.
Mm-hmm.
Because this also kind of detracts from the position of a teacher when teachers misbehave or do inappropriate things are exposed to the students. And unfortunately, here in America, I've seen recently so many teachers have been doing such dishonorable things recently that they kind of lose the respect that they should have, and they have to maintain that themselves as, you know, as teachers. And many times the respect that we have is that which we've earned, not only because of the title we bear.
Mm-hmm.
And but bearers of that title, we must behave in a respectful manner, because then we will acquire that respect from our students. And right now we have teachers who are really trying their best, but due to the economical situation, they are not. I don't want to use the word rewarded, but they're not paid properly for their services. And normally, when a person becomes they don't feel compensated, they tend to lose that interest sometimes, and it reflects in their work and ultimately their students. And if we're having this on a broad scale in America right now, due to the fact that Dennis said it's not placed on a level of high priority, we will have a slow disintegration in this whole school system. So,
God forbid. So, Ron, how can we encourage people to reconsider on a person-to-person basis, or if we have a forum to talk to more than one person, to ask them whether they want to pray for it or just to talk with other people about it, how the greatest resources of this country in America, therefore, again, I suggest for every country in the world, the greatest resources is the human being, not the gold and silver that everyone's seeking, in order to ensure that the world is a settled place, which is fulfillment of biblical prophecy in Isaiah 45:18. The world was created to be a settled place, not to be a chaotic one.
I think the federal government is in charge of allotting a certain amount of money each year for schools. I mean, property taxes contribute to that. And it should really be basically their priority. And another thing, too, is that we should, teachers should be a system in which a person wants to become a teacher because he wants to really be an educator. And in and of itself, a role model also. So a person shouldn't just approach this as being just a profession, just a job, just to get a paycheck at the end of the week. But it should be more than that. You know, he should be inspired. Because when you're inspired, you inspire others. And more than anyone else, your children need inspiration. And many children may not have that at home due to the fact of course, again, the economical climate for both parents with work. Basically, you know, all day, and they just spend a few hours at home preparing, maybe just going through the homework with the child and whatever it is. But the child spends quite many amounts of hours in the classroom. And if teachers can realize that the significance they have in each child's life, then maybe the approach will be a little bit different, and that inspiration could be passed on to them, and to show them the significance of what acquiring an education, you know, what it can lead to, you know. So that's what I feel.
Thank you, Ron. And I don't know about, I don't mean to dwell more than necessary on this subject, but I think it is very important. I can tell you, gentlemen, that not just in my yeshiva education, which goes back about 26 years, since I started later in life in seeking out the culture, the ancient practices of the Jewish people, but even in my secular education, I went to school in the Paramus school system, public school system, which to me I felt very, very encouraged. And I can still remember the names of my first through sixth grade teachers, and I have each one of them. I have one nugget memory, essential memory, which were very positive. And I think we're talking about the end of the 60s and early 70s, going up into the late 70s and 1980, I honestly felt that the majority of my teachers, even in the secular school system, were encouraging the development of the human mind. And I grew up in a suburban area, you know, middle class, and I would say I was middle of the middle class, not upper, not lower, but middle of middle. And I'd say that my education helped me also in my Torah education, because I always felt that no teacher was looking to restrict the expansion of my mind. Dennis, what about your educational experiences? Do you remember teachers back then, the ones who had a good effect on you?
Oh, sure. And the thing that impressed me is that they all had the same goal, and that was to make sure that you learned something while you were in school. And I thought that was pretty impressive because, yes, there were different individuals, but they all had the same objective in mind. But then again, that was before we let politics into education.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, by allowing politics into education, we induced alternatives that are not necessary because they were established a long time ago. So we started hybridizing things as opposed to just concentrating and focusing on an education of a young mind.
Ron, just a final question to you before we move on to the next segment of the program. Do you have any positive memories of teachers who you felt were pushing in the way of expanding your mind in your secular education in Guyana?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And actually, I appreciate them more now than I actually did then,
mm-hmm.
because they were very, very, very strict, and they were very demanding. And it's only a result of that attitude that they had actually encourage us to acquire an education, because if they were just, you know, laid back, you know, we would have just did whatever we want. We would have done just whatever we wanted to do, and eventually we would have, you know, not learned anything at all. So I actually appreciate them very much now, and I actually wanted to become a teacher.
Huh.
But I just didn't think I had the patience it required.
Well, and I got some news for you. By virtue of your participating in this program, you're a cyberspace teacher.
Oh, that's for sure. Like.
Anyway, gentlemen, speaking about mind expansion, encouraging the student to expand in their mind, coupled with simple faith, we're now going to ask Dennis to, I hope you have it in proximity to you, Dennis, Moses Maimonides, physician, scientist, and philosopher, which was edited by Dr. Fred Rosner and Dr. Samuel S. Kotek. So, Dennis, if you have the book in your proximity, what page should we go to?
We're going to page 92, Don.
I'm right with you.
Okay, because this is an interesting thing, because it espouses Maimonides' opinion on what is science and how is it related. A lot of people say that he was for science, against science, etc., etc. So let me begin page 92, and it's called Maimonides' Approach.
Okay.
What is Maimonides' view on this question? Did he also believe that the sciences could or had reached closure? There is one clear-cut reason for thinking that he had. Maimonides opens the second chapter of his Mishnah Torah by telling us that Jews are commanded and fear God. What is the way, Maimonides then asks, that will lead us to love him and fear of him? The answer, he says, examination of God's work of creation. By way of helping his reader to fulfill the commandment to love and fear God, Maimonides explains, quote, some large general aspects of the work of the sovereign of the universe, unquote. Chapter 3 and 4 present and 4 present an account of the physical universe as Maimonides saw it. It is a finite universe composed of 9 concentric spheres, which the Earth is the center. The 9th and largest includes and encircles all things. 8 of the internal spheres is divided into subspheres, like the layers of the onions. These subspheres are contiguous with no empty space between them at all. In addition to the concentric spheres, which encompasses the Earth, there are smaller spheres, epicycles fixed into the largest spheres. Whoa. The heavens are alive in the sense that they are populated by living, thinking entities. The sublunar realm of the world of the four elements of the bodies composed of them. It is a world in which things strive always to return to their natural place. It is a world of constant generation and corruption, a world that most fundamental principles of which are form and matter. Maimonides' description appears in the Law Code, the Mishnah Torah, in a section called Laws of the Foundation of the Torah. Maimonides composed his code in apodictic fashion because he expected it to be exactly that a code. Furthermore,
Dennis, I'd like to. I'm sorry. What does apodictic mean?
You got me. I've read the dictionary a couple of times, and that word doesn't ring a bell with me.
Okay.
I'd have to look it up, Don.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
Okay. Maimonides composed the code of an apodictic fashion because he expected it to be exactly that, a code. Furthermore, it was a work meant to translate the immutable Torah of God into useful, manageable body of specific prescriptions. It was Maimonides' hope that the Mishnah Torah would be adopted as the binding code of Jewish law. It is reasonable to assume that Maimonides expected his vision of the physical universe to be as immutable as his codification of the laws, say, of death. This being the case, it would seem that Maimonides would have to have held that the physical sciences at least had reached closure in his day. Otherwise, how could he present them in the apodictic fashion that characterizes his discussion in the Mishnah Torah? The matter, however, is not so simple. There are good grounds to think that Maimonides, did not present the description of the physical universe in the laws of foundation of the Torah as the last word on the subject. Among the reasons for supposing that Maimonides would urge us to relate to this account of the universe in the Mishneh Torah is being nothing more than a statement of best science available in his day, and not an incontrollable account of the world as it is, was, and always will be, are the following. He gives now a couple of pointed reasons. Number one, the strongest reason for understanding Maimonides in this fashion is his account of how we ought to relate to scientific pronouncements of the rabbinical sages. He sharply distinguishes this role as transmitters of the syniatic relation from their role as individuals reporting on their own ideas and interpretations or reporting on the best science of the day. Indeed, in two passages of the Guide to the Perplexed, Maimonides informs his readers that sages erred on scientific matters. If Maimonides thought that sages could err when they relied on the best science of the day, would not Maimonides feel the same about his own reliance on the science of the day? Two, further support for this position is found in Maimonides' attitude towards Aristotle. Despite his tremendous admiration for the chief of philosophers, he still maintained that Aristotle would err. It is well known that Maimonides rejected Aristotle's claim that the universe was uncreated. Furthermore, Maimonides held that Aristotle was indubitably correct in what he had written about the sublunar world, but wrong with respect to how much what he had to say about the celestial world. Once again, if Aristotle can be mistaken about scientific matters, would not Maimonides admit that he himself was mistaken? Number three, yet there is a further reason for thinking so. Maimonides held that human beings progress both scientifically and in spiritual terms. Maimonides easily thought, and in quote, science of astronomy was not in his Aristotle's time what it is today, that Galen had brought anatomy to the high pitch of perfection, and that his own astronomical knowledge might be superseded. Without getting into the vexing question of when the idea of progress entered Western culture, we can see here that Maimonides admitted the fact of scientific development and even anticipated that science would develop beyond what he himself had been able to accomplish. Number four, in terms of what is called spiritual progress, and that's in quotes, Maimonides indicates that the human beings grow and develop from generation to generation, both as individuals and as a race. As individuals, Maimonides maintained, in the most notorious passages in the guide, the generation of Exodus was unable to worship God in a truly mature fashion and needed a sacrificial cult. Our forefathers may have been religious primitives, spiritual progress had taken place since the days of Exodus. However, some Jews in Maimonides' day were ready to be told how to truly worship God. It consists of setting thoughts to work on the first intelligible and to devout oneself exclusively as far as this is within one's capacity. And that's another quote. Second to the last one, individual human beings had progressed spiritually to the point where they can worship God through intellectual meditation. Eventually, all human beings will progress to the point when they abandon idolatry and embrace Judaic monotheism. Thanks to the intervention of Christianity and Islam, the world is being slowly monetized, thus making possible the eventual advent of the Messiah, which happens to be an opening subject that we discussed this morning, which with such human development passage, it is credible that Maimonides would think of the description of the universe presented in his Mishneh Torah would never become outdated, and that's a question mark. The last point is, Maimonides, it turns out, for all the interest in presenting the Mishnah Torah in apodetic terms, was not even wedded irreparably to the details of his account of halacha presented here. He recognized the fact that he could err, correct mistakes which he caught himself, and admit that the fact that others found mistakes in the work, it was fairly clear that Maimonides was willing to admit in halachic matters that the Mishnah Torah was not necessarily the last word. He would even more than willing to admit that such was the case with scientific matters.
Wow, Dennis, that was beautiful, and it covered so much stuff. We'd have to take the rest of the show to break down some of the stuff, but I just want to go back to something that I think you wrote on the last show, which was March 25th, that the idea of that Jews are commanded to love and fear God, that, again, we have to understand that when we go to the text itself, now, when Dr. Rosner and Kotek put together this book, I think that they were aiming primarily for a Jewish crowd who perhaps were not the most observant, or maybe they were modern in their perspectives on how to worship God according to the Jewish tradition. And I think Ron will confirm this with me when I turn to Ron for his feedback, that all of us are committed not to worship idols. So instead of us taking that energy towards that negativity of worshiping something of stone, metal, burning incense to a picture of someone or a statue of something, that we need to redirect that energy, and the most healthiest form, and just coming to my own mind, that we can redirect that energy, or to think there's some sort of intermediary force which is ruling the world, like, say, that we would like to defeat. And unfortunately, some people want to worship, like, say, like the Satan, which also we call the Yetzirah. We turn to the creator of all these spheres that you just mentioned, Dennis, the ninth sphere and the spheres under it with the layers of onions. And we turn to him out of love. And we also fear to break that relationship for the fear of the repercussions of breaking the relationship with the all-powerful, omnipotent one. As well, I think it's a very good point, and I think this is something that I think even the Babbage Rebbe talked about. Rabbis or rabbinical leaders or prophets didn't come here to teach the world science, although some of them, and many of them actually throughout our history of people, have engaged in science. And I don't think anyone who was seeking the truth would be so arrogant to say, well, my word is the final word, because Torah as an eternal transmission, which preceded even the Mount Sinai experience and culminated in the Mount Sinai experience, was never meant to be just put down in stone and become a static transmission, meaning it should be able to allow for the human being to go through what we call the plasticity of human consciousness, meaning, you know, when you mentioned earlier the idea of the sacrificial cult, I think that primarily was aimed at the idea of the worship of the golden calf, meaning Israel at that infant stage of our development of national consciousness had to make that big boo-boo, which had a lot of negative repercussions even to this day, according to our oral Torah tradition, in order that we should realize we should not sacrifice anymore to a cultist or cult-like sacrificial rites. And unfortunately, in our history, this did take place, and we could read in the Tanakh where the prophets chastised the nation of Israel for going back to those sacrificial cults as opposed to the true purpose of the animal sacrifice and the offering up of even vegetative sacrifices or burning incense, whatever, free will offerings, peace offerings. But no one in their balanced mind, from a Torah perspective, and I hope from a Noahide perspective, as it starts to develop more and more, the consciousness of all the blessed nations of the world, no one's going to advocate that they are the final word, that they are the final summation of these teachings. Because I would even humbly suggest, even the Mashiach will go through a process as he leads all of us into his universal redemption, that he himself will have to go through the process of expanded consciousness. So he's never going to put something in stone, but rather experience and grow with these teachings, in order that we can expand with this, you know, expanding universe, which is created by a creator. One of his attributes he's associated with is being Ein Sof, infinite. So So how can a finite being put in stone that my teachings up to this point will be the final word when history has shown no one really has the final word except Almighty God? Ron, what's your take on this stuff? Ron, are you there?
Hello, yes, I'm here. What you said before about, you know, written stone, I think that phraseology came from the Ten Commandments being actually written in stone. But the thing is, you cannot take something that's infinite and actually contain it in a perspective or even atmosphere. So nothing, of course, is in this world the last word, because we're seeing now even science is basically proving wrong. It's not only wrong, but inconclusive constantly. So 100% we cannot define anything as being totally, set at any one period or another. You spoke earlier about Maimonides mentioning that love and fear of God is not limited to only the Jewish people, but the entire world. Many of these documents written prior to modern era had to be written in that fashion because of the fact of the persecution from the church. Everything was basically censored by the church. So many things that are written, man, it actually means the entire world, all humanity. So loving and fear of God is actually a condition that must be met once you decide to observe either the Shiva Mitzvah or the convert to become Jewish and keep the 613 commandments. So, my mind is responding to the entire world when he spoke about loving and fearing of the Creator.
Okay. Gentlemen, now we've reached about almost the halfway point. So I'd like to play this song now of which I'd like you to hear. Hopefully you'll hear it very clearly. I think I'll play it at a volume. You should be able to hear it clearly. This is by H. Fox, or it's spelled H-A-Z-I-E-L. It's called Children of the Earth. And to me, it's universal. And I'd like to comment, again, I hope you, Dennis, and you, Ron, will be able to hear this song clearly. And then if you think I'm falling into some sort of other faith. I mean, I don't think I am. But here comes the song. It's called Children of the Earth, and I really believe this is a song to awaken, whether this was the intention of Mr. Fox or not, to waken up a subconscious, a superconscious remembrance of what Adam, who is the container of all human souls, of all human history, on a primordial level, meaning we are all the peoples of the earth come from Adam and original woman Eve. So here's a song, I think, which hopefully will wake up some ancient DNA in all of us. But I want to get feedback, hopefully, from Dennis and Ron and Dennis on this. And anyone who wants to call in as well can call in at 347-838-8669. But first, we have to hear this song for the next 3 minutes and about 30-plus seconds. Hold on, everyone, and enjoy the song. I think it's a great one.
Just teach
Anyway, gentlemen, for some reason we lost the song. Dennis and Ron, were you able to hear the song clearly?
Very clearly.
Now, did that, to you, promote any ideology of one particular denomination, or did you sense the universal message?
Children of the earth. Doesn't matter if you're Jewish, Christian, or Islamic. You are children of the earth. And to me, I think what brings everybody together is that we love God. And in the song, it said, feed some love to me.
Right.
And yes, no matter who you are, no matter what you call yourself, you must identify with God and eventually love him or learn to love him. Or else
yes.
You'll be wandering the earth and not really be children of God or children of the earth.
True. Ron, did you hear the song clearly?
No, actually, I didn't, but that's not a fault of yours. I think my hearing is a little impaired. But I think that our relationship with God is universal, regardless of whatever so-called, you know, religious denomination you like to you're born to compare yourself to. I feel that what we share in common as humanity is a lot more than what makes us different. And according to the Torah, we must understand that the Creator chose a certain set of people to be the bearer of his message, the witnesses of his work, and the remainder of us, we're all connected to them and to him because the message that they bring is the one that he wished for us to receive, actually. And it's universal. Our work is all intertwined. You know, B'nai Noach, B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, and all the sons of man, all of us. And as a result, it's more universal. It should be, and it will be, a more universal theme than one of a specific religious denomination.
True. Gentlemen, before we go on to the next section, I want to share a poem, and hopefully in future weeks I hope to share more. I've already done it on occasion. From Blessed Brother Saul Exiled, that's the name of his Facebook page. It's a capital E-X, then a space, and I-L-E-D, which exiled means, you know, not redeemed, you know, out of one's land of redemption, whether it be in physical land or spiritual land, spiritual consciousness. But he writes beautiful poems of unity and feeding off that song, Children of the Earth. I'd like to read this poem and then get your comments, gentlemen, before we move on to us reading from and sharing more Torah teachings. Because to me, this is also a Torah teaching because it's about love, ahava. That should be brotherhood, should be the aim of this creation among the created beings, all of us human beings, all blessed and anointed with that divine image. Here it goes. This is by Exiled. A rainbow lives in my heart, a simple promise made long ago, and no matter what they say or do, I and I will always know that a promise is a promise and every word is real. A rainbow lives in my heart, and every word will be fulfilled. Say, this world is hot enough, so why add fire to fire? Come cool me down with your love. The flames can't get much higher. They can play their games and rearrange, shun this love, but it still remains the same. They can turn off the light and call it dark, but the rainbow still lives. A rainbow lives in my heart. Dennis, your take on this poetry.
Well, it's like calling out to say, why don't we recognize the basic facts of life, and that is what's in our heart is where we should be going. And that when we make a promise, it's a good intention, but if we don't follow it up, it's an empty bag of air.
Dennis, I like your bullseye simplicity. Ron, your take on the poem.
For me, I heard a promise is a promise, and you know, a promise always requires participation of two parties. And we see that the Creator kept his part of this bargain. You know, he never flooded the earth again. And it's just up to us to keep our part of the bargain now. And that's it. You know, we have the rainbow as a reminder of that covenant. So.
Yes, yes. So now let's go now to Rabbi Nachman, who we've been sharing for...
One second, Don.
Yes, yes, Dennis.
Apodetic. Expressing or the nature of necessary truth or absolute certainty.
Can you repeat that again, Dennis?
Expressing or the nature of necessary truth or absolute certainty.
Okay. I guess I'll bring that... I'm sorry, go ahead, Dennis.
One other thing is the airing that was mentioned in the reading from about Moses Maimonides also relates to the poem to a certain extent. And that is that the details are not that important, but the concepts must be upheld and will last for eternity.
Beautiful. And apodictic. It sounded like a word apodaca. He used to be a pitcher for the New York Mets. So I'm going to show my coworkers tomorrow that I knew a no word, and not that I'm having memories of just the New York Mets pitching staff in the 1970s. So that's my wry sense of humor. Now let's move on in a more serious level about the idea of the attributes by which one can acquire the Torah. And, we turn to Rabbi Nachman, who was a great tzaddik who lived from 1772 to 1810, who talks about the attribute, which is one of the 48 attributes of acquiring and, more importantly, internalizing the teachings of Torah. And this is one of them. I will say it in Hebrew, then we'll translate it. Ma'amidu ala shalom, meaning when a person learns Torah, it should lead a person in the pathway or the standing of peace. So Rabbi Nachman, as he's accustomed to in addressing each attribute, my beloved one, my son, that anyone who wants to learn Torah, the divine instruction, and I'll insert whether it be the written tradition or the oral tradition for the sake of the creator of the whole world, and wants to cling within his consciousness into the letters of the Torah and knows that each letter and word is from the Holy Torah and that there are many sub-combinations which each the Hebrew letterings which are bounded upon deeper dimensions and the secrets which are still, some of them have been revealed, some of them haven't been revealed. All of this should be that a person gets a certain insight, that a person should increase his connections between him and his friend and him and his creator. And this type of knowledge, to increase one's connection with the creator or to increase one's connection with one's fellow man, is to guarantee the success of that soul's mission in this world, to know the Torah of the Most High and to know that the Torah is the wisdom of the creator. Then the Torah shall stand that person in a path or in a way of peace. And not only that, the person will be drawn continually to seek not just inner peace, but to increase the peace of this world. As it says in the Talmudic tractate in the 64th page, the first side, the students of the wise increase peace in the world. So the litmus test of one's Torah learning, blessed souls, if one wants to come and say that they're learning Torah for the sake of for its own sake, what are we doing to increase the peace in the world? Now, we're not talking about a type of Pollyannish presentation of peace, when I just stick up two fingers in the air and say peace, 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 meaning to bring peace into the world is to recognize different people have different ways of looking at things, but rather if we can use divine instruction to bring two sides of the same coin to realize they're made of the same precious metal, blessed and decreed by the Most High, that this is the type of peace we're talking about, that the Torah should empower a person, and the success of one's Torah learning is indicated by what are we doing to make the world a place where, in a place of many opinions, and everyone has a different viewpoint, even if we believe in the same thing, that there's still a level that's above our perspective, which will hopefully humble us and bring more peace into this world and accompany us with more peace as we enter the future world, which is even, we're talking about the times of the Messiah, the universal redemption, even the time of the great resurrection. And we should understand this in a way that we bring it into action. So Dennis, how can we encourage other blessed souls and among ourselves in this little fellowship here, that the reason for our learning is to bring peace into the world?
inherent in love of God is peace. And that peace is what comes from the Almighty. And some people even say maybe it's happiness. We don't know, but each individual must experience this. Maimonides, throughout his life and his teachings, always told people, why don't you think of God? If you think of God, and he didn't guarantee anything, he said you will be on the right path. So if you can think of God, doesn't matter if it's a minute, 2 hours, a day, anything, just think of God, you can't go wrong.
Beautiful. Ron, how can we encourage people to realize when they learn scripture, they learn the oral Torah tradition, or the Sevenai Commandments, it's about making this place more peaceful. And we could find that if we make this world more peaceful, we're going to find ourselves more at peace with ourselves, between ourselves and our fellow human being and our infinite creator.
I think we have to be first and foremost a conduit. But to be a conduit, we must have this, whatever we are transferring, we must have it within ourselves to begin with. And one of the criteria for having peace in your life is acceptance. Accepting that whatever station, whatever you are, whatever it is at that point in time in your life, this is sanctioned by the Creator, and that the Creator always knows what's best and what's right. And you come to an inner understanding, and you come to an inner peace. And from that point, you're able to become a conduit of that peace unto others. Because if you don't have it, regardless of what you learn, what you study, it'll still be that tumult, that unrest inside of you, and you really wouldn't experience that peace. And honestly, if you don't experience it, it's very difficult to inspire another person. So first and foremost, we must work on attaining and acquiring that peace within ourselves and our relationship with our essential being, which is a piece of the Creator. So I personally am a strong believer in that, you know, whatever you wish to share, you must experience it to a certain extent to be able to sincerely share that or encourage others.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my standpoint on that matter.
Beautiful. So now we're going to turn, gentlemen, and blessed souls listening out there, and again, anyone who'd like to chime in. I mean, I program the show relatively very close in proximity time-wise to this live broadcast, so if no one calls, it doesn't bother me. If you do call, that'd be great. All the blessings upon you. You can call 341-347-838-8669. And if you missed the live show, of course, there's always the archive version. So now we're going to turn to Rabbi Rogalsky and Rabbi Klorfein's what I consider to be an essential book, and I think Ron will back me up on this for anyone who wants to learn about the Sevenoi Commandments, The Path of the Righteous Gentile. Ron, I don't know if you have it with you or proximity to you. We're going to turn to page 35 in The Path of the Righteous Gentile in this section called Returning to God. And we're going to deal with some very personal issues, things that we can talk about that are personal because everyone's experienced these things. And we'll hopefully get feedback from Dennis, Ron, and Dennis. So here we go, page 35, teaching number 6. One should not say that repentance, or teshuvah, as we say in Hebrew, applies only to sins involving actual deeds, such as forbidden sexual relations and theft. For just as a man must repent of those, he must become introspective concerning his evil characteristics and repent of them from his anger, and his hatred, and from jealousy, and folly, and from the pursuit of wealth and honor, and excessive gluttony, and other base character traits. From all of them, he must return to God. For a person who is sunk into these bare pursuits and evil traits, he is hardened to abandon graver sins involving actual evil deeds. And Rabbi Rogalsky and Klorfein are actually quoting from none other than the Rambam. A good portion of this book is actually rooted in Rambam because the Rambam elucidated very clearly the Sevenoi Commandments. So going to Dennis now, how can we encourage people, Dennis, to become aware of the fact it's not just their actions, which actions we cannot minimize the implications of negative actions, but also things about a person's characteristics which need rectification.
There is a famous Jewish person who said, if you commit sin or crime in your mind, you are guilty, and you should ask for repentance. So it isn't just a deed. He basically said, it starts in your mind. Well, to avoid this, you must control your thoughts and try to concentrate on positive things. So yes, it's not the easiest thing to do for humans, because our mind sometimes wanders all over the place. But the one thing you shouldn't do is wish bad on other humans, because that leads to all sorts of ideas that come and go that you don't want to entertain. So based on what he said, the whole idea is catch your thoughts as they come through. Don't wait till they become deeds.
Dennis, I'd like you to identify that famous Jewish person, because we're not here into censorship. We're into agreeing to disagree and disagreeing to agree and agreeing on all levels. So there's no. I think I know who you're quoting, but please, just for the record, quote it, because I want to make a comment, and then we'll let Ron chime in.
That was Jesus of Nazareth, who when asked, when does one commit a sin, he said, it starts in your mind.
And guess what? Obviously, he believed in an oral Torah tradition, because these teachings that Rambam talks about were not innovations of Rambam, but merely the traditions that were passed down. So obviously, Jesus of Nazareth adhered to the oral Torah traditions.
He adhered to all Jewish law.
Yep. Ron, your take on all of the substance we are discussing, because without you, we're not the Three Musketeers of Cyberspace Radio.
After you read that portion there, I reflected on what we spoke of earlier about having peace.
Mm-hmm.
And this inner peace comes after you've come to terms with this type of feelings that you may have of anger and your evil characteristics. And many times people seem to, including myself, we seem to not have enough regard for those thoughts and feelings, because they're private, they're only within us. So the fact that they haven't become manifested into the world, we just disregard them. But if we keep harboring them or never address them, actually it creates a distance between us and our Creator. And the Rambam spoke of this in the 8th chapter, Shmoneh Perikim, I think, where he said that whatever actions we perpetrate becomes our character eventually. It's not vice versa. So here, if we find we busy ourselves with good actions, positive actions, it actually has an influence on our character. So it may be very difficult to control your thoughts, which is, you know, virtually everyone has experienced with this. But if we channel our action into a positive action, it could be like speech, always finding something good to say, always being positive, always looking, giving someone any type of doubt, what we do actually is we redirect our thinking process. So many times we may not have full control of our mental capacity, but through our actions, we can actually rechannel our thinking. And there's where we can actually do that, you know, tweak our minds into thinking in a more positive fashion. As a result, we remove that negativity, which eventually becomes part of our deeds.
Mm-hmm.
So, back to my mother again, he basically gave us the cure.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
All humans were given free will. You use the free will by adjusting and changing, but you only change if you want to. But anybody can change at any time. You have the mental capacity to do that.
Beautiful.
Question is, do you want to change?
That's true. I mean, on the simplest level of of truth finding, or a mission of trying to be more truthful to oneself. All we need to do is, when we get up in the morning and we're brushing our teeth, washing our face, whatever, rinsing our mouth out, gargling with the mouthwash, look in the mirror, straight in the mirror, and saying, this is who I am physically. Is this the person I want to be as an expression of the divine image? Because Rav Moshe Karavero, the Ramak, who was a Kabbalistic master who lived in Sfas in the 16th century, talked about, yes, we all have the divine image, but it is not befitting for a human being to experience life in this world where he carries the divine image but does not carry out principally in his good or her good actions, because to be bequeathed with that divine image and not carry out the divine image as it manifests one's actions is basically to, is basically like putting the finest of wine in a dirty vessel, meaning the dirty vessel does not testify to the grandiosity of that fine wine. With that being said, this is something that a lot of people have worries about if they choose the path of return, gentlemen. And I'd love to hear, I'm anxious to hear what you both have to say on this as we continue from teaching 7 on page 35 and Returning to God by Rabbi Rogalski and Klorfin in The Path of Righteous Gentile. A true penitent, as we say on Hebrew, a Baal Teshuvah, should not worry that, as a result of his or her sins, he or she is a long way from the exalted status of the righteous. And again, this is a teaching from Rambam. The truth is that he is loved and treasured by the Creator as if he never committed a sin. Moreover, when he repents, his reward is enormous. He has tasted sin and departed from it, and has now conquered his or her evil inclination. This makes him far greater than one who has never tasted sin, for he has achieved a greater spiritual conquest. Dennis, your take on this teaching.
Well, the Lord will redeem almost anything, and that means he forgives you. But that doesn't mean he automatically forgets, because if you have a habit of doing this over and over, how sincere are you at changing? So therefore, you can be forgiven, you can start anew again, but we all are creatures of habit, and that's something we as humans cannot get away from. So therefore, we must be mindful of this and sincerely agree that we're not going to do it again. We can try and try, but we'll be forgiven, but not necessarily forgotten.
That's right. Ron, your take on this matter. How can we encourage someone who wants to turn back to the ways of the Most High, according to that, his or her standing at that particular moment, and how they should understand that that courageous, momentous moment where they want to return to God, Almighty God, that they will be loved and treasured by the Most High as if they never had done something wrong?
I feel they should start focusing on what King David said, turn from evil, do good. Once you've asked for forgiveness, I mean, there is no precise way of knowing exactly that the Creator has forgiven you. But I think as a good faith gesture, on our part, what the next step should be is to start doing good. Start trying to do the opposite of what you did before. Because one thing I can tell you is that, you know, you apologize to someone for hurting your feelings or doing whatever wrong you did.
Mm-hmm.
That person may accept your forgiveness because you're saying it, but they're watching your further actions. And if you start, if they see that your actions have changed, in their heart they will say, okay, fine, he's turned a new leaf, he's changed, and the forgiveness goes in effect. So basically, with our Creator, this is what we have to do. We have to just turn from evil and do good. You ask for forgiveness. And instead of dwelling on the fact that am I forgiven, am I not? Because we can never really know for sure, but what we can do is start doing good, because that is like a guarantee that you will be forgiven.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
No one is asking for anybody to do great things, great deeds, great thoughts. We're just suggesting good thoughts, good deeds.
Yes. And I want to mention, too, that, you know, Dennis, you brought up a very great point. how do we know that the Most High, and again, this is not to place guilt on any person, but just to be very real about the condition of man or woman falling from their true spiritual status, which is to be spiritual beings living in a physical body. I think there was a song about it by the Police many years ago, "We are spirits in the material world," but our material world is affected by our actions manifested through our physical bodies. Now, Dennis, you mentioned that the Most High doesn't forget, but also King David mentions that, "For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is always before me." Now, again, "You alone have I sinned and done that which is evil in your ways. Forgive me." So you will be justified in your verdict, vindicated in your judgment. Now, what King David is trying to do is not to give us a guilty conscience, but I think in the positive side, what King David is telling us, if we have our sin or our misdoing always in front of us, it is the impetus for our growth. It is the impetus, it is the conduit by which we can redirect, which were previously squandered energies. Because energy itself is not negative or positive, it just happens to be part of creation. Energy, or koach, as we say in Hebrew, is something that we can access as long as we're living here upon this living earth. And if we recall our misdoings, and even on a higher level of understanding, according to the inner dimensions of Torah, a chet, a sin, also means even if I'm doing a positive thing, a good thing, I have to ask myself an honest question. Could I have done more good at that particular moment or any particular moment? And hopefully that will inspire us not to get into a negative self-esteem mode, but rather to recall our misgivings, our misdoings, or even the lackings in our doing good, to say, hey, next time I'm going to give a better attempt. I'm going to make a better effort to do what's right in the eyes of the Creator and between other human beings. Dennis, any feedback on my perspective?
No, but yes. what happens is we have habits. They're humans. The good Lord takes that into account. But he still says he has an open arms and an open heart. Whatever you want, but make sure you're going in the right direction. Yes, there are little bumps in the road. Just stay away from the big ones, please.
Ron, your perspective on how, for certainly Hashem doesn't forget our lackings, but how King David encourages us to remember them as well in order as an impetus for growth.
I heard once by Maharish Friedman when he was debating on the Tani, he said, when did King David said, "My sin is before me"? The wording is very important because he didn't say within me or upon me. He said before me, which means outside of him.
Mm-hmm.
So the penitent must understand that the sin is no longer part of him. It's something that is like outside of him now. But nevertheless, it's more like a fence now he should build to know that he's on one. And, it's very easy to fall again in the same direction. So you constantly should be aware of your past misdeeds. And you kind of like be vigilant and also accepting of the, as King David said, your verdict means we ask for forgiveness, and then if by chance things in our life appear not to be going the way we want them to go, we should always remember that we have not been so good in the past either, and many things can be a form of an atonement for our misdeeds that we've done. So King David is also reminding you that your sin may be before you, but you also should be accepting of the verdict that may come as a cleansing effect of that sin that you once perpetrated.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, Rama. And who Rabbi Manus Friedman happens to be a emissary of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. May his marriage protect us, Chosi Yogan Leino, out in Minnesota. He runs a women's institute and has been an educator for the last 40-plus years out in Minnesota. And he actually happens to be a direct descendant of Rabbi Yisro Baal Shem Tov. So a little bit of the Baal Shem Tov usually crystallizes in the teachings of Rabbi Manus Friedman. And he also wrote a book I'd like to recommend to everyone. Maybe in the future, we have so much material to cover, gentlemen, blessed souls out there, that I just want to, you know, that whatever we're talking about is just a tip, actually a molecule of the tip of the iceberg of Torah knowledge that's out there and accessible to all beings, whether it be in Hebrew or English, whatever. And he wrote a book called Doesn't Anyone Blush Anymore? I'm just throwing that into cyberspace for anyone who wants to get their head and wrap it around the ideas of modesty according to Torah standards between a man and a woman. It's an excellent book. It is by no means a prudish presentation of the sexuality between man and woman, but rather an adult presentation for those who want to serve God in all of their ways. Anyway, I want to direct everyone now to the next to last section of our show, Pulling Out of Compassion for Humanity in the Jewish Tradition by Rabbi David Sears. And now, these are teachings which are directed directly to the Jewish nation, the Israelite nation, but hopefully all human beings will learn from this as it applies to their own particular lives, especially Noahide business people. So this is quoting from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, Rabbi Yehuda, the pious one, who wrote a book called Sefer Chassidim, 600. I guess that's the page this was pulled from. It says the following: stealing from a Noahide is even worse than stealing from a Jew. For aside from the intrinsic evil, it may lead to greater harm. The Noahide victim may be feel justified in later avenging himself upon another innocent Jew. Also, the rest of the local Jewish community may suffer in reprisal for the actions of this one sinner. So, let's talk about the dysfunctionality of stealing. Dennis, what can we do to encourage people to avoid bringing their own community to become stigmatized because of what might seem to be an innocent act, which might have very negative repercussions for a larger community of one's own culture or the general culture involved in the surrounding area?
Well, you got to remember, you basically prefaced this topic as addressed to Jews. And,
right.
And to me, that's not a bad idea at all, because I expect Jews to have a higher standard, because they should know better. Most of them have been educated, and they understand intrinsically what their religion is about. So therefore, they have to practice the best practice so that they can be examples to everybody else. Same thing with a learned person. Any learned person must be an example to other people. So we always show by example. And that is the way to cut down on social problems that may expand in any particular direction. So therefore, if our heads are pointed in the right direction and we follow good deeds, then life should be easier to live.
Amen. Ron, your take on this teaching?
I just want to take one of the things that Dennis just mentioned about learned people. And he said that the Jewish people have been educated in the learned people. And the thing is, what we're trying to promote here, three of us, is that we all should become learned people. Because In a society, a country, a world, where people learn it, then we wouldn't have to be worrying about these, about theft and all these misdoings. The problem is then we live in a very materialistic society that predicates itself on acquiring as much as you can. Not everyone is capable of acquiring things legally, but nevertheless, the spirit of acquisition is still alive and well. And as a result, things are done in a very, inappropriate fashion, which is directly linked to thievery. Learning this, the commandments, the Judaic commandments that were given directly to the Jewish people, or the seven mitzvahs, which were given again at Mount Sinai, the laws of theft are basically identical. And it's what we're learning right now, myself and my other class, in the Talmud, where it is brought out in a more practical form. And this is what I really suggest, that should be learned by everyone, because our laws are identically, they're the same, and they're in the oral tradition where it's really reasoned out. In the written Torah, thou shalt not steal. But there's a lot of other gray areas where we may not feel be directly connected to theft, but it actually is. So, as Dennis mentioned before, we should all become learned people. We should start, and today's a good day to start. You know, any day that you start is a good day because it's a start, and this is how we all acquire also favor from the Creator, because when we realize that when we keep His commandments, keep His bounty upon us, as a result, we don't have to revert to such things as thievery to acquire our material needs or wants.
Beautiful. Gentlemen, I'd like to go back now to the last segment, which, you know, we're trying to explore verses in the Torah. We're going way back to chapter 2, verse 12 in Genesis. Now, we're learning about the four rivers, which are considered to be the four headwaters of the creation. That the river went out of Eden, and the first name of the river that went out of Eden was called Pishon. And we're continuing in that mode by reading verse 12, chapter 2, that the gold of that land is good, and also there is bdellium and onyx stones. And I'm just plucking out of the Torah anthology that the from the oral Torah tradition that the that there are seven grades of gold, and the Torah said this is good gold, which is of the highest grade. Now, I'll be honest with you, I don't know where geographically this land is, because I think if any of us knew where it was, there would have been probably a gold rush in the moment that we all found out where this land is, or perhaps all the gold was excavated. And by the way, if anyone lives in the New York City area, you want to learn a little bit more about gold, there's an excellent exhibit. There's an exhibitory type of film which is about gold in the Museum of Natural History, which talks about the history of gold, at least in the West. They give a little bit of a history of gold, in the ancient countries, the ancient civilizations, but how the pursuit of this precious metal actually caused migratory patterns, you know, in America to go out west. And I just want to throw this aside for anyone who wants to do a little more research on the history of gold or. But one thing that was brought out that I think is interesting, and I don't remember if we talked about this in the last show, that actually at one point in the 19th century, aluminum was considered to be a more precious metal than gold, but then through the process of oxidation, aluminum was made so bountiful that today, of course, you know, we don't wrap our sandwiches in gold wrap, but rather in aluminum wrap. Dennis, Ron, any take on these matters? We'll start with Ron. Usually we start with Dennis. We'll start with Ron now.
Actually, it's funny. You chose me first. I have nothing basically to say.
Okay.
On this matter.
Dennis, I know we talked. You mentioned something about gold last time. If you want to chime in something else, or.
Yes, I'm never at a loss for words, Don. Gold of that land is good. Gold and beryllium and onyx stone, those are considered precious gems. That's to impress people that there's some type of value there. But to me, it's the wrong impression, because whether there's gold or not, the land is still good, because it comes from God. So, to me, to emphasize this verse, is a nice thing, but it's almost of a secondary nature, because as I read it, it hits me, and I'm sorry that I'm messing up the English. It says land is good. Whether there's gold or not, there is immaterial. Whether there's oil or gold, and you yourself said gold and silver. You sort of put that down as a human evaluation of things. Well, in effect, what we're trying to do here is bring it up to a higher level. So the land is good is how I read that whole passage.
Okay. I just want to retort that, again, this is the what was written down by Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, a prophet, that I think perhaps what's hinting to is in order for us to understand that the gold of the land is good, perhaps we should understand what is the higher good of gold that we should recognize as good, as opposed to just being used for ornamentation upon the human body or for statues or for impressive buildings, that there's a good that still has not been been revealed to human consciousness, that the Torah itself and the five books of Moses should identify the gold is good. Now, of course, every land is good, every land is holy, every land is embedded with precious jewels, whether physical or spiritual, just that man, the human condition, has not revealed these matters.
Don,
yes.
Gold will never get us into heaven. And when God judges us, he's not going to say, how much gold do you have? Or how many precious stones do you have? This is, I think, is a human convention to try to impress people of something that's precious, which I don't have anything against. I just don't think there's strong spirituality or religious significance in it. So I sort of agree with you, Don.
Okay. No, but again, just saying that there is something embedded in this teaching. Again, this is a transmission from God to Moses that we are not fully conscious of yet. So when we try to wrap ourselves around it, I think we can throw our hands in our air and say, God, please reveal to us, or we'll let the Mashiach, the Messiah will come and explain to us, what is that good that we need to be told about, of that gold of that land? Gentlemen, guess what? We have just come to the end of our programming. I'm going to end off a song called Finally Here. It's called a cappella, in the spirit of the period between Passover and the giving of the Torah, the upcoming, God willing, the 3,324th anniversary of the giving of the Ten Commandments and all the other 603 commandments, including in the seven Noahic commandments. I want to conclude the show with a CD I just got. It's called A Cappella Soul, which means you're going to hear music now, which has no musical instruments, just human voices replicating or trying to emulate, instruments. But before that, I want to thank Dennis Ryan and Ron Williams both together and individually, because, gentlemen, I missed our 5 week, I think it's about 5 weeks since we got together, and I want to thank God publicly that we can reunite at this level, and hopefully we'll continue at future shows. And so, Dennis, I'll give you time to sign off and make your concluding statements, and Ron as well.
If there's one thing humanity wants to be known as, it should be lovers of God. Your religion is not going to change anything if you love God.
Beautiful. Thank you, Dennis. Ron, your concluding statement before we turn to Finally Here by Ari Goldwag.
I think we should believe in ourselves and the good that we can bring with whatever God has given us, because he believes in us. That's the reason why we're still here. And he believes in the good that we can do. So we just have to start doing that. So that's all.
Beautiful. Thank you, gentlemen. And for those who heard our live broadcast, thank you. And probably for the majority who have not heard it yet, we hope you'll hear the archive version. Your comments, questions will be welcome. And hopefully I will be joined by Dennis and Ron. Ron and Dennis next week. This is Don signing off. And everyone, please enjoy Finally Here. Take care, everyone.
Going.